soldiers of the cross.
That's music from Greg Brown. Kind of a different treatment there. Jacob's Ladder, the name of the song. Before that, from Wayne Watson, A Beautiful Place. It's 10 minutes past the hour. It is a Tuesday morning, and that means Dr. Don Clark joins us from Garden Valley, Texas, down in the I always said groves. You don't call them groves, do you? Grape groves.
No, they're called vineyards.
Grape groves. I just had just this kind
if
of...
If it was olives, you could call it an olive grove, yes.
Well, yeah. Groves have to be trees, don't they, I guess, to be a grove. It'd have to be trees. You have apple groves, but not grape groves. But the alliteration is nice, grape groves. And Don Clark, biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments, and a good friend of the station. In fact, he's the only scientist we have on staff here, and we delight in talking with Don just about every Tuesday morning at this time. Don, how are things down in Garden Valley? Is it still summer? Is it fall? What happens in Texas this time of the year?
Well, it's finally turned to fall. We are getting some cooler weather, and the highs are trying to hit 70.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we get into mid-70 today, but the nights are getting down into the 50s, so it's definitely getting cooler.
Okay, well, that's probably a good thing. So I'm just curious if you really see a distinct four seasons where you are, because Texas always just strikes me as kind of hot.
Oh no, we get colder, obviously colder weather in the winter, and come January and February we could actually get some snow.
Okay.
We don't get it necessarily every year, but that's
good to know, because misery loves company. You know that.
Oh yeah, I mean you folks probably have had snow, and you probably now at 10 feet of snow.
Yeah. If, well,
10.7.
Yeah, that's right.
10.7. Yeah, 10.7. Right out the backyard there.
Yeah. Yep. Well, actually, there is, David, I hate to tell you, there is snow in the forecast later in the week.
Yeah, I know. I know. We've been having a really, really long, gentle fall.
And it's been nice.
Long-range forecast is supposed to be for El Nino to have its effect, but yeah, I've been promised these things before.
Yeah. So. Well, we never get our hopes up here.
No, I just... If I get a half an hour extra of sunshine someday, I know I'm going to pay for it next week.
Yep, the other foot will fall.
Oh yeah,
Don, we have a full agenda today. We're going to be talking about glyphosates and Monsanto, and this is another of Dr. Mercola's article over at Mercola.com. And then we're going to address some questions that have been submitted by listeners and visitors to the Creation Moments website. So we have a lot of ground to cover today. We've talked about glyphosates before. First of all, tell us, what is a glyphosate?
Well, it's a compound. It's a compound developed by Monsanto as a herbicide, and it's actually a chelating agent, and it chelates. That means it holds on very tightly to metals. And so one of the mechanisms by which glyphosate acts as a herbicide is it sucks up all the essential metals out of the plant, and the plant can't survive. So it shrivels up and dies. So Monsanto's kind of on both ends of the development. First, they developed glyphosate as a herbicide. Most people know it as Roundup, and it's the active glyphosate is the active ingredient in Roundup. But the other half of the picture is that, of course, Monsanto does a lot of genetically modified crops as well, and corn being the most popular of those, but they're also doing wheat and other crops. Now, the genetic modification allows farmers to spray Roundup on their crops and in their fields to control weeds, but without doing a lot of harm, at least to the corn. That is, so the corn won't die, but the weeds will die. At least what it was designed for. Mm-hmm. And that's why they started genetically modifying the crop. So the Monsanto gets a profit, obviously, not only from the Roundup that they sell, but from the genetically modified corn.
That's wheat. A pretty neat business plan, I think. You make something that kills, and then you make something that protects you from the thing that kills, and you get paid both ways.
That's right. Now, the only problem with that is that glyphosate has not only been proven now to be toxic, but is on the International Agency for Research on Cancer, or the IARC list, which is the research arm of the World Health Organization, has determined that glyphosate is indeed a probable carcinogen. Now, this was in not only humans, but in animal studies to show that glyphosate causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as well as lung cancer in humans and possibly other types of cancers. This is a big problem, obviously, and there's a lot of lawsuits against Monsanto from farmers who've used the product and are turning up now with cancer. It's been about 30 years since glyphosate's been available and on the market, and all of this time, of course, Monsanto has strongly suggested that this is the world's safest herbicide that's ever been produced. And that's what they tout publicly, and they've touted it to the farmers and to our government repeatedly. They've had folks inside of the FDA, for example, who have been Monsanto, who used to be Monsanto employees, have been in the FDA to get their products approved. So Monsanto is not what you would call a consumer friendly company. Mm-hmm. They're out obviously to make money. Internal research and memos have shown that indeed glyphosate is could possibly be a carcinogen. And we even have possibly some internal employees who are now trying to get some retribution against Monsanto because of their false claims. Mm-hmm. Monsanto is now in what you would say hot water, but they continue to tout that this product is safe, and that genetically modified corn and other products are safe, and they've gone now so far as to there was a HR bill that was recently passed in Congress, is now in the Senate, and it's called HR 1599. The title of the bill is the Safe and Accurate Food Label Act. Now, that sounds really good, and it's almost akin to the Affordable Care Act in that the title is just the opposite of what it does. Mm-hmm. Because what essentially it does, it shuts down any potential labeling of GMO products. In states, some states have passed their own laws, California being one of them, that, hey, folks, you gotta label your products. If your product is labeled, for example, that it's a potential carcinogen, that there's got to be a warning label on the box. Well, of course, Monsanto was fighting that. But some states that have tried to pass and have passed some GMO labeling requirements, this law does away with those. It's like the federal government
overruled the states. Then
it's overruling the states, and it's overruling the people who want to know what's in their product. Mm-hmm. Now, this bill is so bad that it actually goes so far as to say that GMO products can be labeled as natural. So, which is a far cry from reality, obviously. And so the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act is just the opposite of that, calling unnatural foods natural. And they're putting even another layer on organic growers, for example, that they must get pre-approval from the government to say that their products don't have GMO ingredients in
them. Pre-approval to say you don't have something.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is... this is a travesty. So I would encourage the listeners to contact their congressmen have already passed this. So it's in the hands of the Senate, and good luck with that.
This doesn't sound like something the House would have passed. H.R. 1599, huh?
Yes, 1599. Okay. It's called the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act.
Now, that's this year's version. I've got 4432 up on the screen, but it's from 2014.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed this bill in July 2015.
Oh, okay, it's the new version. Okay, it's the updated version. Who is the sponsors?
Representative Pompeo.
Now, Chris Smith from New Jersey was one. He was the original, or he was the one who introduced it. Wasn't the same guy who introduced the 2014 version.
I think that's who it is. I mean, it's not really clear from the article, but we keep getting snickered by our politicians and by big corporations. And, Democrats often claim that Republicans, are all for big business and will promote things like this. But you bet your bottom dollar that the Democrats have a big role in this as well. Mm-hmm. So
you have to find out who Monsanto may or may not have contributed to among these authors of the bill. Be an interesting study in itself.
H.R. 1559 was introduced by Chris Smith from New Jersey, a big farming state. one of the major agricultural forms.
Yeah.
And it was introduction referral. On the end of March, it was referred to the Subcommittee on Health. Did you say it's been brought to the floor and voted on?
That's what the article says. It was voted on in July.
Passed by the House in July.
So, okay. Yeah. All right.
By the House. Mm-hmm.
Okay. For whatever reason, and I'm on congress.gov, and it's only got dates in March on there.
Huh. Now it's in the Senate where Nancy Pelosi will vote for it and then read it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, there we go.
It was heavily sponsored by the food industry, in particular the the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which Monsanto, of course, is a big part of that organization. And the folks that were allowed to speak on this were all associated with either the giant food industry or with Monsanto and similar type of companies. So this is not an unbiased, bill, and it's been sneaking through without much public fanfare. Like I said, if listeners want to contact their senators and let them know they heavily oppose this type of bill, that would be a good thing to do.
And I suppose if you actually wanted to read the bill, you could. You could Google it, and it'll probably pop up. And you could read the text, which will be no doubt daunting and take you about half a day or maybe 2 days to read. So you got to wonder how many representatives and or senators are actually acquainted with the text of this thing, rather than just a summary prepared by their staff. So, and yeah, it's
suspect. And the experts coming to talk to them, obviously, with their grease palmed already by, by you know, the big food industry.
Oh, the cynicism, Don.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, how cynical.
Well, but when you see, you know, fellow scientists, for example, getting their palms greased as well by Monsanto, to speak highly of Monsanto, when indeed they already know that the dangers of the product and the crops is a bit disgusting.
My apologies, I was on the wrong number. I misplaced one of the fives, or one of the nines, one of the other. But Mike Pompeo from Kansas introduced the bill.
From Kansas,
it,
okay.
Yeah, and it it passed the House on the 23rd of July, and yeah, it's been received by the Senate and read twice. It's now in the Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee. Over in the Senate, and hasn't been passed out of the committee yet. So
okay, well,
that's where it's at.
The details of H.R. 1599, well, not all the details, but a summary of it, is present in this article from Mercola, which we will link in our podcast later. So, but, well, in fact, I'll put it in the window right now, in our chat window here, and people can check out the article at Mercola.com and see what you think. And maybe this is worthy of some action to you. So there's the link in the chat window. You can follow it over to the Mercola article and use your own judgment, your own discretion in this. Don, we've had a number of questions from visitors to the Creation Moments website, and we've got a long list of them. We're going to address three of them today. And are you ready to go there?
Am I ready today? Sure, why not?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what.
Let's go for it.
You've already ruffled my feathers with the first part of today's discussion, so I've got to collect my thoughts here. I'm still angry. feel better now. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, it is. It does ruffle your feathers. I mean,
it doesn't make
like anything. Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the time, you know, in the Bible that talks about evil will be considered good and good will be considered evil. And you know, here we have again a title of a bill that is that does just the opposite of what it says. As in its title.
And it's not only corrupted thought, it's corrupted language, like Affordable Care Act, as you've mentioned. We right. twist the words, male, female, marriage. We Christians just give up on those words too soon, you know? And I'm thinking some other words that come up during every year during the Christmas season, things we've given up, like X and Christmas, which used to be a revered Christian symbol, Xmas. And now we've let it become a symbol for eliminating Christianity and Christ from Christmas. We just surrender that stuff too easily. And language is another thing. We should go fight for that. Words like marriage, words like affordable in this case, words like truth get corrupted, don't they? Here's a question for you. I'm going to get off this before my blood boils here. How would an evolutionist explain Dutch elm disease? Now, this is a bigger question than Dutch elm disease. It goes on. It seems to me that it's not very productive for the beetle involved in Dutch elm disease to be killing the tree that keeps it alive. Dr. Don, maybe you could do a program on that or any other instance where one thing kills its host instead of helping it. The nature of parasitism. How does that work, Don?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and obviously Dutch elm disease is only one disease. Of course, here in the South, we have the pine beetle that it's a big beetle that bores holes into pine trees, and you can have whole sections of pine forest completely destroyed by the beetle. And it brings up the question of these. It's not only insects, but like fungal diseases and other types of diseases that cause problems with plants and, of course, you know, ultimately humans as well. Obviously, this goes to the fall, but you know, plants, although. In Genesis, the Bible talks about, as we talked about in a previous conversation, that there was not death before the fall. Well, there was not death of humans, and I and others purport that there was not death of animals as well. Man wasn't allowed to eat animals until after the flood, when the environment completely changed from a more perfect environment that was before the flood, or actually right when everything was created. It was perfect, as God says, until a less perfect environment, and a much less perfect environment after the flood. And so to get enough nutrition, God permitted man to start eating animals. But what about the plants? Well, the plants are something else, because God did say that you should eat the herbs and the seeds and the fruit from any tree that has a seed in it. And so plants were eaten not only by man, but also by the beast of the field and the animals. And it's certainly possible that the plants would have died naturally, and you would have needed, for example, a cleanup crew to return the plant material into viable soil and add carbon to the earth and all the good stuff mm-hmm. that the green people talk about, which was quite abundant at the time. So typically, these type of beetles and insects will go after a diseased tree, for example, or a diseased organism, a diseased plant, more readily than they would from a completely healthy plant. A completely healthy plant has built-in immunities to let's say, fungal infections and other type of diseases. Than one that might get injured, for example, where there would be a port of entry for this beetle to get into, or if it suffered some other type of damage to it, it would be more prone for further degradation, if you will, and for further eating. Now, going back to the original question, how do evolutionists explain this? I don't know how they would explain it, because it certainly is quite explainable, from a creationist point of view, that God created, obviously, animals and microorganisms to degrade plants in particular, and trees and stuff. A tree or a plant got injured or was overcome, to allow it to degrade back down to the elements, to the soil. How does a beetle evolve to pick a particular type of tree, for example, or a fungus or any other thing that might be highly specific to one particular type of plant or tree than another, is a quite interesting question. Of course, it's easy to explain from a design point of view why that might be, and there would be different types of beetles that would might degrade different types of trees, and certainly the pine beetle is different than the beetle that attacks the Dutch elm tree, for example. I don't know how they would explain it, quite frankly, probably would say, well, over eons of time, the beetle and the tree evolved to form some type of coexistence. But unfortunately for the tree, the tree winds up being injured so much that it eventually dies.
Well, in a way, I think that's survival of the fittest, isn't it? I think maybe they would lean on that.
But if that was the case, then you wouldn't have any more Dutch elm trees anymore. And if all the trees died, then you would supposedly lose the beetles as well. So mm-hmm. there are, it's like defeating the purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you kill the host and you have no more food available for you, from an evolutionary point of view, what good is that?
Well, but I'm thinking that argues to there being no plan. It would fit the evolutionary scheme of things. It's just one of those. It's random. Evolution allows for that, I think.
Well, but these types of beetles, for example, and as well as other types of diseases, are pretty specific to the type of trees.
Well, I mean, that's not random, but it would be random in the sense that a beetle designed to attack a specific tree would eat itself out of existence and just may do that, and that would be acceptable in the evolutionary scheme of things, because there's no plan for this beetle. It just happened. You know, it's like coincidence.
Yes, but it obviously the millions of years of evolution that supposedly had taken place, this beetle and the tree are still around. Mm-hmm. So they haven't eaten themselves or out of existence. They're still here. Now, do they? You know, one could argue that the beetle might evolve and pick another type of tree, mm-hmm. Eventually.
And it's not necessarily a given thing either that a parasite is always harmful to its host. I think of the remora, which attach themselves to sharks and feed off the scraps that the shark leaves as he swims, and they're actually helpful to sharks. And I think there are others, more benevolent relationship between host and parasite than this particular example. So I think this is a pretty heavy duty subject, really.
Well, it is, and we could have probably taken a whole segment on this itself. So it is it's an interesting question. But obviously it's easily explainable by creation and God creating, these types of relationships, as I say, you do need a cleanup crew. If you had a tree that fell and it wouldn't get any fungus on it, for example, or insects to start chewing it up, that tree would be there an awful long time, and the material inside the tree wouldn't be available to be used by other trees. Mm-hmm. But if you go into a forest, for example, and you see down trees, these trees actually act as a nursery for the start of new trees. And so that particular process is very, very important for reestablishing or continuing to establish a nice, strong, healthy forest.
And I think it would be helpful just to note that the Creator God made this a highly interdependent system. And there are levels of dependency that we probably haven't yet discovered yet even. You think of all the there's still so many new discoveries being made by botanists and physicists and chemists, things you figure we should have known that by now, but these are new discoveries. We continually are amazed at the depth and complexity. The smaller things get, for example, the more complex they seem to be, and that's an astounding aspect of creation, I think. We still have a long way to go to figuring this thing out, I think.
Well, and one of the common things in science is the more you look, the more you find, and the more mm-hmm. you keep looking, the more you keep finding, and the more you learn that you are just barely scratching the surface.
And so much of what you learn as you continue to look changes what you believed before.
Well change your premise as to, gee, I thought, if you have an open mind,
that's true.
You know, and you start to look at this and you say, this is more complex than any evolutionary process could explain. Mm-hmm. Then you would perhaps come to the conclusion that maybe there was a creator and designer of all of this that was far smarter than we are.
Well, and the next question posed today kind of has to do with that, and that is, how do we learn? What kind of resources are available for us to learn about this stuff? Next question comes from a visitor to the Creation Moments website. What books and DVDs do you recommend for people who are just beginning to learn about biblical creation and evolution?
Well, I can list off several books here. Actually, one of the first books after I became a Christian that I started reading was the Genesis Record, and it's basically a commentary by Henry Morris, who's no longer with us, but he was the founder of the Institute of Creation Research, and he wrote a commentary of Genesis called the Genesis Record. And when I started reading that commentary after the scales fell off my eyes, mm-hmm. if you will, I said, this is the only possible way it could have happened. And so that's a very good book. He also wrote another book called The Genesis Flood, which covers a lot of information about the flood, how the flood could have possibly occurred, and about the ark and the animals. And so the Genesis Flood is also a good book. Now both of these books are not paperback. Well, you might be able to find them in paperback now, but they're pretty heavy books, heavy from the point of view that they're thick. Mm-hmm. They're not
not hard to read, then.
They're not hard to read, but they are pretty thorough. And Henry Morris was quite thorough in his research, of course, and in his commentaries. But other books, Guide to Creation Basics, would be an easier book, and maybe an introductory book to read. So that was a Guide to Creation Basics. And then another one is Creation Basics and Beyond. So those are two companion books that you could start with, the Guide to Creation Basics, and then follow that up with Creation Basics and Beyond, and get a very good overview of the whole creation science background, and would provide you with some good information to begin to make your case against those who would say that, creation couldn't have possibly happened. But this would give you good background to say, oh, not only could it not possibly happen, it did happen, and here's some good evidence for it.
Mm-hmm. Are these available from Creation Moments?
That's a good question. I didn't search their library to see if those available. They are available at the Institute of Creation Research's website, but you can try to go to Creation Moments website to try to find these.
Yes, creationmoments.com, creationmoments.com, and the Institute for Creation Research is icr.com. So you can search both of those sites and see if they have those books for you.
So, and there's many good DVDs, available on on the subject, and you can go to creationmoments.com to search for, very good DVDs on various topics in the creation.
And another good one from my own experience here is the Truth Project. If you can get involved with that at your church, or get a hold of the DVD series, you'll learn a lot from that. That's a superb production, and has a lot of good information on creationism. David, did you have a thought there?
Well, I was just looking at the library, my local library here, and I found one called The Genesis Enigma, Why the Bible is Scientifically Accurate. It's an 09 book by Andrew Parker. Mm-hmm. My particular library didn't have Creation Basics or the Henry Morris works, but they could probably get them at other libraries around the country.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Lee Strobel's book, too, Case for Creation, which I read, which is short. It's easy to read, but gives you a lot of the basics. He's got some great interviews with scientists who have done 180s, who were basically evolutionists, and said, well, wait a minute. They discovered something, analyzed it, and said, no, that can't be right. And you read about that, too, in The Case for Creation. Lee Strobel is his name, former journalist from the Chicago area, who has written a series of books, Case for This, Case for That, but The Case for Creation is particularly well done, and will acquaint you with some of the research that's been done that really refutes evolution. And that's our point here in these conversations with Dr. Don, is that there is scientific evidence, not emotional, not dogma, not theology, but science, that says creation happened. And it just happens to kind of match up with what you read in Genesis. So you can think of Genesis as a starting point. It's not science. Genesis is not a scientific treatise. It's history. But there can be truth in history as there can be truth in science. And when the two merge, you know you got something solid there. And in this case, the case for creation is a strong one. Don, there was a third question. What was the third question we were going to deal with here?
Oh, the individual said that I saw an advertisement for a video called Evolution versus God. It's a documentary by Ray Comfort. Mm. Do you think it's any good? Well, the answer to the question is yes. Ray is very good at presenting logical, helping individuals to see their fallacy in their logical fallacies in their thinking. And in this particular video, he interviews students at universities who don't believe in God or don't believe in God and believe in evolution, and then challenges their belief by asking pointed questions. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who is interested in challenging, let's say, your student or children that are going to college or preparing to go to college, you might want to watch this video to get some good insights as to how you can challenge a young person's thinking to say, well, you know, maybe this isn't logical after all, and I've got to look for another alternative. And of course, the alternative is that there was a creator God.
Mm. You know, my wife has that talent, pointing out flaws in thinking. she's very good at it, and continue to be just amazed at that.
She's never corrected me.
Well, you haven't. We should get together for dinner sometime. I think we should do that. Yeah. Don Clark is a member of the Board of Creation Moments, a biochemist, and just a good friend. And we thank you for your time and your thoughts and your expertise once again. And we'll look forward to next week. So, Don, have a good one. And we'll talk to you then, okay?
Okay, sounds good. You folks have a great week, too.
Bye.
You too, Don. See you.